Well, welcome to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California for Monday, July 27th, 2015. This was the week in which many Republicans demanded that Donald Trump apologize to John McCain for denigrating his time as a POW. You all saw that story. Comedian Steve Marmel noted, quote, "Donald Trump was asked if he owed John McCain an apology. He said no. Of course he said no. If Trump owes anybody anything, he doesn't apologize. He files for bankruptcy." So thank you for joining us today here in San Francisco. I'm John Zipper, your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. On today's program, we are going to talk about the latest in the never-ending presidential campaign, perhaps even a little about you know who. We'll talk about developments in the sanctuary city policy and the ensuing controversy, the minimum wage stuff happening there, as well as more local, state, and national political news and views. As usual, any views that are expressed up here are those only of the panelists and not of the Commonwealth Club of California. So let's meet our panelists for today. Starting on the far end is Deborah J. Saunders, a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, where she's also the token conservative blogger at sfgate.com. That's actually what it's called, folks. She's on Twitter at Deborah J. Saunders. Next to her is Daniel Borenstein, a columnist and editorial writer for the Contra Costa Times, the Oakland Tribune. He's on Twitter at Borenstein Dan. So he put his first name last. It's very tricky. And next to me is Josh Richmond, state and national politics reporter for the Bay Area News Group. He's also a political blogger at ibabuzz.com/politics. And he's on Twitter at Josh_Richmond. So Deborah, Josh, try it with your name at the end. I hear that's the happening thing. Just give it a try. So please use the question cards that are on your seats to write down and submit any questions. I will try to ask as many as possible during the program. So let's get started with our roundtable, and I do want to start with presidential stuff. But before we get to Trump, the New York Times recently ran a story. Did you see this late last week about a original story was a criminal investigation that was being pursued into Hillary Clinton's emails. This involves that private server that she and President Clinton have at their home. Very soon, however, that story started to change and fall apart, and no, it wasn't criminal, and actually it wasn't asked for, blah, blah, blah. It obviously kind of played into the Clinton campaign's ability to, if you will, do rapid response, which is something they were kind of famous for. But there still is a serious issue there, and I'm going to start with Deborah there. I mean, so what did you think when you heard this story? Beyond this will certainly play into worries the Clintons have always had about the press.
And conservatives feel that the New York Times buckled. The deal is, I have a Nook, and that means you shouldn't buy one because whatever technology I go for is like out the door. And I get the New York Times downloaded in the morning, and there are already corrections in a lot of the stories and stuff. And you'll see that if you just, you know, since we're on the West Coast, the stories go up Thursday night, everybody's on the phone, and they peel stuff back. So this is actually a pretty typical thing to have happen. But the New York Times looks bad because it had reporting based on anonymous sources. But we know this because we've seen the letter. One inspector general, there was talk of two, asked the Department of Justice to investigate. And you know what? The Department of Justice doesn't look at parking tickets, right? The inspector general looked at 40 out of 3,000 emails and found that four of them had information that should have been classified secret. Now, come on. We know that if she was using her email for work, that this was going to happen. She's the Secretary of State. She's not the parks manager. And this is going to be a problem that keeps coming out, the fact that she basically wiped clean the server after she turned over some 3,000 emails to the State Department, and she kept another 3,000, and we're supposed to trust her on her word that is, private. That doesn't end well, and the fact that it's starting out this way, I think people are looking at it. Democrats say no one's going to not vote for her because of this, but it reminds people of all the other problems with Hillary Clinton, and I do think that it will hurt her, and it should, because when you are Secretary of State, your documents are part of the public record, and they should be accessible to people who manage that kind of thing, look at that kind of thing to the inspector general and other things. And it's wrong what happened.
I can't help but when you say Democrats say that people aren't going to vote for her because of this.
Are going to not vote for her.
I think there are people who won't vote for her because of this sort of thing. And I think that this is problematic. I think that this continuing stream of stories, that the whole server is going to get exploited, the whole email server, and it's creating a story that they were slow to respond to begin with. It's so Clinton-esque, if you will, in its nature, slow response. It's the cover-up is part of it. It's a story that peels the layers away one by one by one, and it goes on forever. I think that it may not be this story, but it just feeds into the preconceptions of a certain voter. And who's that voter? It may turn out to be that swing voter that turns out to be important down the line. That's the issue, I think.
Let me preface this by saying I'm a reporter and they're columnists, so I have to be a little more careful. But definitely more careful than that, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the Times screwed up, but there is something there. It is a terrible narrative, to have when you're running a presidential campaign. I think the deal with those four emails, correct me if I'm wrong, is that they contained secret or classified information that was not marked as such that had gone to her and that she then either replied to or forwarded on from her private email server. She was not the originating source of that information. Doesn't negate the fact that she was receiving and transmitting this, classified information on a private email server. And I think it, as you have people like Carly Fiorina or Jeb Bush or Rand Paul, for that matter, talking about the importance of being a 21st century tech-savvy president, if you don't understand how to send email, or what the pitfalls are of having a server like this, that's not under classified government control, then it raises questions about judgment, if nothing else. So,
you brought up something I wanted to talk about, which is former Florida Governor Jeb Bush recently visited San Francisco. He hailed an Uber ride. So does this establish him as a tech-friendly front runner? Is he going to rent out his mansion on Airbnb?
No, but I think his willingness to come here and do that underscores that you can't underestimate the guy. He's obviously not, super tech savvy the way that some of the candidates have tried to position themselves. But he came to this. He took the Uber ride to this startup here in the South Market area, and talked to a crowd full of people. And he took some tough questions about marriage and employment equality for LGBT people, about gun control, about things that you would expect to hear from a San Francisco audience. They were not necessarily a supportive crowd, but he answered their questions very honestly. On the gun control issue, he basically ended with, well, we're going to have to agree to disagree on this, And he's a much better communicator. This may be setting a low bar. He's much better communicator than his brother, especially in these smaller groups. He may not be a... And he actually said this himself. He'd love to have the charisma of a Barack Obama who can hold an arena-sized or national audience-sized, group in thrall. But he's good at connecting with people in small groups. And you underestimate him as a campaigner at your peril, I think.
I saw him at the National Auto Dealers Association in San Francisco in January. And he was just... he was awful. Mm. He was so boring. And then I went to this event at Thumbtack, and he was just incredibly accessible. Is he a front runner, John? No. I still don't buy that. He's going to have to work for that. Really? But tech savvy, I have to disagree with you a little bit, Josh. He was one of the, he got a BlackBerry before a lot of other people 15 years ago. And this is funny. No. Hillary has it. He's so transparent. You had a good. You were talking about how he took questions and difficult ones, and that really compares to Hillary Clinton. If this is going to be Clinton Bush, right?
He also gaggled with the press for 15 minutes outside of this event, which, let the record show, Secretary Clinton has not been willing to do on her visits to the Bay Area.
So. But also, he started emailing like 15. He sent a note afterward to Carla Marinucci, my colleague, and he said, "Hey, Carla," in a tweet. Remember this email exchange we had 15 years ago? He saved all of his emails and put them up online so everybody can read them. And that really is an amazing balance with Hillary Clinton again. And it showed that 15 years ago he was, hey, I'll just talk to people. And I think his email is something like jeb@bushsomething.com. I mean, you can actually Google it and find it. And he started letting ordinary people email him, and he would send out a couple answers a day. So that shows, and the other thing is, Hillary Clinton trashed Uber in the last month, and she's basically saying, I'm going to side with the, you know, incumbent industry, like they say, taxis, limos, and whatever, against kids who want to be able to earn some extra money renting out a room or driving for Uber, and that's the stand she took. Now, Republicans are trying to get young voters, and Rand Paul up until now really was the only Republican who seemed to know how to reach out to those people. Jeb Bush is making a move there, and it's the most impressive thing I've seen him do in this race.
When you say, is he a front runner?
No.
And I guess my question then is, well, then who is? Because
nobody.
Nobody. Yeah, okay. I mean, but isn't he... Hillary. To a certain extent, by definition, well, yeah, Hillary on one side, obviously. Yeah. But on the Republican side, he's swamped the field in money. To a certain extent, doesn't that really make him certainly a front runner, if not, you know?
Well, you can't be a front runner. It's like being number one.
But there is, right now, it's such
a... If you have 17 candidates, I think you can have a few front runners.
Well, okay. But, you know, so, I mean, is he somebody to watch? Is he a likely nominee? Yeah, if you want likely for three people or four people.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
So do you know who I like?
I do.
Well... But you know who I'm really fascinated about getting into the race is John Kasich, the Ohio governor. He is somebody who's going to bring, he's coming from the middle, and he's vigorously campaigning that way. And I think he's going to be somebody, so I'm telling all of you, watch John Kasich, okay? He came in 4 in this poll in New Hampshire, and that's before his big buy, because he just had a big ad buy. In New Hampshire, he's somebody who, and he's gonna fight Jeb for New Hampshire, and he's human like everybody else and has his flaws, but he is a fascinating candidate.
And I'm glad you brought up John Kasich, because there are, when you've got so many candidates in a party, it is easy for kind of the more colorful ones to take over and obviously get the attention, and that is where I'm eventually going with this, but. It is somewhat of a shame, both, I think, for Republicans and Democrats as well, who want serious discussions, because there are quite a number of Republicans this year who are of substance. You might disagree with them. You might disagree with them strongly. But, you know, Scott Walker, Jeb Bush, I would say, Kasich, Lindsey Graham. I mean, there are some you could have a very interesting civil and a civil conversation in which the differences between them and the Democratic opponents are very clear. And yet, we're talking about the Donald.
Don't do it. Don't do it, John.
We're going there sooner or later. As a Republican, that must worry you. Does it make you shred things when you're just thinking about the folks who are not getting the attention that they could?
Okay, so he's like... Donald Trump is the GOP's Voldemort, he who should not be named, right? And he's going to steal a lot of attention, and then he's going to crash. And he's probably going to make the first debate, because he will come in, the Fox News criteria are criterion. It's one, the criterion is that you have to come in the top 10 in a mix of 5 polls, and we don't know what the 5 polls are. And by any measure, Donald Trump makes it. But And it's just, you know, but he will not, you know, he's not going to win. So,
isn't it better that it's happening now? Isn't it better that it's happening? We get this Donald Trump out of our system, you know, before.
So do you know why Donald Trump is popular? Because people hate us in the media. And he keeps trashing the media. And every time he trashes the media, he bumps up. Now, okay. There's a finite number.
Republicans have been trashing, you know, Sarah Palin did it too. You didn't see her skyrocket quite to the extent that Donald is like the unchained id of the Republican Party. You know, he's tapping into something, and he is going to crash. I have absolutely no doubt of it. He's not going to even be around when the caucus rolls around. I'm sure of it. But, you know, he is tapping into a very basic sense of fear and resentment and anger that people have. It exists on the left, too, and there are people, you know, who are trying to mobilize that to some extent. But, you know, Trump is a showman. He's in his element here. He knows how to tap into, how to push people's buttons, and he is gleefully going to push as many buttons as he can, you know, until somebody takes the keyboard away. You know, but to say that people are, you know, obviously people are identifying with him. He has hit something that is powerful. You know, he wouldn't be topping these national polls right now, albeit with 18 or 19%, you know, in a very fragmented field, if people weren't hearing something in him that they like, right?
So, okay, but is it possible people say they like Donald Trump just because they wouldn't necessarily vote for him? But they like what he's saying this week, and so
right, but
just
if they like,
it's sort of
if
like they're
like
pushing
what he's
their own
saying,
button.
Then they're going to want the other ones to say it too.
Yeah.
You know? So he is influencing the way. I mean, you know, you see it in Ted Cruz, you see it in Mike Huckabee, the people who are. I never thought I would characterize those guys as being in the middle of the Republican field, but compared to Trump, you know, but they're adjusting their rhetoric, and really some of the others are too, because they see that he's hit, you know, there's nothing more powerful in politics than anger and fear, you know, no matter who's wielding it on whichever side of the spectrum, people respond to that.
To what extent are we in the media creating him?
Well, you know, if we don't cover him, then we get accused of not, you know, of not covering a candidate who's at the top of the polls. So I mean, you know, what do you do?
He wasn't at the top of the polls when he hadn't announced and nobody thought he was going to run. Everybody had to run out and get that interview. And by the way, he's not really a Republican. I mean, I know he's registered as one now. He used to be registered as a Democrat. He's in certain years, he's given more money to Democrats than Republicans. So, mm-hmm. Some, you know, including
Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's something that he's really gotten a pass on, and he shouldn't.
Yeah, but really, what about this notion that we in the media, are creating this? I got hammered at a dinner the other night about this, you know, because, you know, the media and looking at me are we giving him too much play? Are we giving him too much coverage?
Well, of course. Would you rather write about, you know, Donald Trump's latest comments, or would you rather write in depth about John Kasich's budget proposals or Hillary Clinton's solar energy plans, both of which are far more important than anything Donald Trump has to say? But it's not as much fun for you guys, right?
It's really hard to cover this race because there are so many candidates in it. And I, you know, Hillary's climate change proposal came out. I haven't read it yet. Now, there's a time I would have read more about that, but I feel like I'm being buried alive.
Well, when you get to the actual general election,
that's different.
That becomes a different thing. Yeah. But there is a certain problem that's happened here where the Republicans have allowed, or not have allowed, they've created, or they have, this Mongo field.
Look at Josh. He's got this look like, I've read it. Yeah. Look at him. Look at him.
What do you mean? I think if people think he's a jerk, then we would report on him, and he wouldn't be at the top of the polls. You know, I don't think we create goodwill for a certain set of ideas just by reporting on
them. No, we create goodwill by by covering him as a buffoon, and then everybody, and then all these people knee-jerk come to his aid and say, how dare you treat our buddy?
That's not what's going on. Look, it's not a question of creating goodwill. And it's not, let's be realistic. When you spread the field so thin, then the polls become, you can jump out ahead with such an infinitesimal amount, and for just a certain portion of one party in this country to spread it so thin and then to try and jump ahead, you don't really need a really thoughtful group of people, with all due respect, to get there, right? I mean, all you need is to grab the attention of 15% of one half or one third of the registered vote of the party of one party.
We have a question that from the audience that kind of goes right into that. It says, Donald Trump bashed the Mexicans and they said he would lose the Hispanic vote. Then he bashed McCain and they said he would lose the veterans. Yet he continues to be in the lead. What is the lesson to be learned here?
There are no Latino Republicans. No. or not that many, comparatively
and,
speaking.
And no
of
veterans,
of course,
and
there
no veterans too, Josh?
Don't,
there are
don't
no veterans in the Republican? Yeah, okay.
There are definitely veterans in there. And I would dare say that the veterans are part of the 80% of Republicans who don't back Trump at this point. The rolling average there's a website called Real Clear Politics, bookmark it. They do it nationally. They do it for the early primary states. Right now, Trump is in the lead in the six most recent national polls, 18.2%. Next closest person is Bush, 13.7. Doesn't sound like much, but that's actually quite a lead compared to how it's going in some of the early primary states. But again, that's 18.2% of Republicans, right? There's plenty of room for veterans and Latinos, and I know a lot of Latino Republicans who cannot believe that this schmo is in the lead, and it is personally deeply offensive to them. So... You know, I think he has alienated a lot of Latino voters. That's less important in the Republican primary than it will be when you're battling for 10 battleground states in November. It's going to make a difference. But he's not going to be the nominee, so it won't make a difference.
But Josh, this is also just plain pure name recognition, too. Let's recognize that, and I think Dan's point was such a great one about how many people there are. And so a lot of this is just plain, I heard something. He said something I like. I'm not really thinking about it because I'm not going to vote for a while. Donald Trump.
Yeah, he's going to flame out.
Exactly.
He's going to flame out. What we saw in the last cycle is everybody had a turn at the top. You know, Herman Cain up there at the top for two weeks, then, you know, somebody else up the top. And when everything was said and done, Mitt Romney was still there, and he got the nomination. You know, he kept it slow and steady and did his thing in a more, you know, some would say a more principled and dignified sort of way, as you see the Scott Walkers and Jeb Bushes and you know, perhaps Marco Rubios of the world trying to do now. Mm-hmm. They're going to let everybody else flame out around them, and that's who you're going to have to choose from come the early caucuses.
Now, can I just say one more thing? The one wild card here is the independent expenditure money, because it keeps, you know, Newt Gingrich was sort of like the master of that in 2012. He could live off the land. You don't have to pay for a huge staff. You can just sort of try. Remember John McCain in 2008, staying at like the Super 8 Motel and with his own luggage, but he didn't have a staff. Now these guys can have staff, so it should flame out earlier, but it won't, because they're going to have all this extra money from, you know, millionaires. You know, you're their pet candidate, and they'll put money for you. So that's the thing that's sort of.
I believe I just saw that Bush, Walker, Rubio, and I forget who the fourth one is. They're all headed to a gathering, I believe it's in Southern California, where the Koch brothers and affiliated donors are meeting, and they're going to make their pitches for these tremendous sums of money. That's where Jeb Bush's money is right now. If you recall, he raised, $14 million in the second quarter for his
Sounds
campaign,
right there, right?
But $111 million for the super PAC. That's where the money is. So
someone asks, how will the Donald flame out? I think we can assume it'll be him insulting somebody, but do you think it'll be a quick flame? Yeah. himself he'll insult, and then he'll, and he's his funder, so at that point he'll get upset and pull the money.
I think the question is how many the first debate is next month, and the question is how many Republicans gang up on him or ignore him.
Rick Perry's been making a very concerted effort to call him out.
That's right.
Of course, Rick Perry is trailing badly in most of the polls right now. So,
And he was before.
And he was
so
before.
So there's like,
yes, yeah.
You know.
He's got nothing to do.
Yeah.
Lindsey Graham's gone after him.
Did you? And
if you have fewer voters than Perry.
If you have a couple minutes, Google Lindsey Graham's cell phone.
Yes.
Because the Donald gave out his phone number, and he did this very funny video about how you can destroy your cell phone. So just.
I liked his tweet, actually. Right after it happened, Lindsey Graham tweeted, I'm considering buying a new phone, iPhone or Android?
Yeah.
Tech
Yeah.
Yeah. He's never sent an email in his life.
Well.
Someone asks if Jeb Bush's wife, who is Mexican, if that will help him get Latino votes. Do you think so?
I don't know about, I mean, it can't hurt. I think the fact that he speaks fluent Spanish and is willing to engage on immigration issues in a way that most of the rest of the field isn't, I think that's going to help him with Latino voters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Back to more of the presidential questions a little bit later. Now, there. I don't know if any of you saw the tweet today. Donald, I've got one more thing on Donald here. Donald tweeted he's going to go take 2 days away from his campaign, or maybe he'll keep campaigning while he's there, who knows, while he attends the Women's British Open at a Scottish resort that he owns. I should say it's probably a super luxury number one quality resort that he owns. Josh, I mean, this is what his campaign is. It's business as business, right?
It's a show. He's a reality TV star. I mean, this is what he, like I said before, he's in his element. If he can say outrageous things and get cameras on him, he's a happy guy.
He doesn't care where he is when the cameras show up.
Yeah.
He can be in Scotland or he can be.
Because he knows the cameras will be there.
The cameras will be there. So he's campaigning. He'll be campaigning wherever he is.
I don't know. I keep thinking British Women's Open. What could go wrong? What stupid thing could he possibly say, right? Yeah. No.
Exactly. Well, let's talk about someone else who I guess now is the moderate force of the Republican Party, Ted Cruz. He's been fighting with, I don't know if you saw this, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and he took Mitch McConnell to task on the Senate floor. Does this help him in his kind of anti-establishment appeal, or does this make him look, you know, I would think, again, in comparison to Donald Trump, who's just like going right at, you know, the media and the establishment, does this make maybe Ted Cruz look to his potential supporters as, why are you arguing so vociferously about the import-export bank, which is what this was about, that 99% of the people don't know what it is, even though it's actually an important issue?
I'm just guessing he's trying to differentiate himself from Marco Rubio, and I mean
shows up for the votes.
Well, that he's Ooh, that's so. The thing to know about Ted Cruz is a lot of Republicans don't like him. I'm one of them, and it's because when he pushed for this vote to defund Obamacare, all it did is hurt the Republican Party, and he just led everybody into a box canyon. Now. He could try to, you know, show he's changed. Obviously, he's decided not to do that. And this fight with Mitch McConnell is his way of showing that he's not really part of Washington. And he isn't, because he's getting into this fight. Now, Kevin McCarthy says that it looks as though on the policy, the whip from Southern California, from Bakersfield, it looks policy-wise as though what Ted Cruz wants to have happen will succeed, because Kevin McCarthy says, no, we're not going to vote on the transportation bill with the XM, Export-Import Bank. So there is a sort of libertarian-leaning constituency that the stand appeals to. I'm somebody who's sympathetic to that, by the way. I just don't like the way Ted Cruz operates. So
While we're on the topic, what do you think about how Mike Huckabee operates? So Mike Huckabee was criticizing the Iran nuclear deal by saying that this was like Obama marching the Israelis to the door of the ovens.
This is what I meant before about certain candidates ramping up their rhetoric because they feel that a certain somebody has already set such a bar for rhetoric that they have to compete. That's not a comment he would have made if I'm almost sure of it. It's not a comment he would have made in that way if there weren't a Donald Trump out there being even more outrageous every single day.
Yeah, and it just lowers the bar to such a low level. I mean, that, that's just offensive.
If you're not offended by that, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
President Obama said Trump and Huckabee were ridiculous and sad. But for the most part, the Democrats have kind of stayed out of this, the Huckabee extremes, the Donald Trump extremes. Dan, are the Democrats successfully following Napoleon's rule to never interfere with their enemy when he's making a mistake?
Yeah, I mean, why step in? Let him self-destruct. In this state, the Republican Party was known for years and years for its circular firing squad. Why the hell would you want to get in the middle of it?
Democrats have their own. It's just a little small.
Small, right.
And nobody's watching.
Well, Deborah, brighter days are ahead.
Well, I mean, it is sort of, let me see. We've been here for half an hour. Well, we started off talking about Hillary. So, there are times when I think, hey, did you guys know that there are Democrats in this state? But tonight we started off with Hillary and then we moved to Donald Trump, which was personally painful for me.
Well, let's talk about something that I think it's fair to say Democrats created and have sustained and are now trying to deal with, and that is the sanctuary city policy here in San Francisco. This has got everyone talking about it. Of course, we all know what happened, the tragic killing of this woman by an undocumented immigrant who had been deported five times or seven times?
Seven felony convictions, five deportations.
Yeah. What I find is interesting is that, well, there's a lot interesting about this, but when it first happened, I know of a local politician who was asked about this in a private conversation who basically said, this won't last as an issue. And before long, he was proposing massive changes to the program and such. It does seem that when you hear supervisors, the mayor, Dianne Feinstein, others who are commenting on the sanctuary city policy, they usually start off with paying fealty to it and then laying all the blame on Sheriff Ross Mercurimi. So I'm going to go to you, Deborah, first. You know Mercurimi. Is that fair? Is he being targeted? I mean, he's been controversial from really before day one as sheriff.
Well, Ross Mercurimi, he believes in that sanctuary city policy, and he was going to enforce it. He also went beyond the policy by sending out a directive to his department in March saying, don't talk to ICE. I'm the only person who talks to ICE. So this is a policy that you can definitely point to him and say he's responsible for it. But when I hear Ed Lee blaming Ross Mercurimi for what happened, when this was that there was a 2013 ordinance, Justice for All, that basically said that the local authorities were not supposed to cooperate with ICE on a detainer request unless the detainer request for someone who had been convicted of a felony in the last 7 years and was facing another problem like that. Now, Juan Francisco Lopez Sanchez does not fit that description. So, according to the policy passed by City Hall, he was in the full spirit of the law, San Francisco's law. You mentioned Dianne Feinstein, who said, oh, no. And she, of course, was a big sanctuary city booster when she was mayor of San Francisco, but it was a different policy. She's basically called on Ed Lee to work and cooperate with ICE. I don't know really quite what's going to happen, because on the one hand, when Fox News sent somebody to City Hall and tried to interview supervisors, and they all basically said, this is Fox News. We don't have to really recognize that there's a problem with the policy. And there is a problem with the policy. But they, and remember, in 2008, an illegal immigrant who had been benefited from a similar sanctuary city policy shot and killed Tony Bologna and his two sons. That's three people in San Francisco. And then Gavin Newsom changed the law back, the policy back. He directed the probation department to not basically go easy on anybody who said they were under 18 and was charged with a felony, which is what happened in this case. And isn't it amazing, though, that 5 years later, City Hall would pass a measure that, if anything, went beyond this because it was for adults as well as juveniles. It's crazy that San Francisco would do this. But there is this view, and make no mistake about it, there are advocates who really believe that if you are undocumented and you've committed felonies, you shouldn't be deported for it. Now, to me, when you're here, whether you're a legal or immigrant or an illegal immigrant, you should be on your best behavior because you don't want to be deported. And if you have all these felonies, or in Mr. Lopez Sanchez's case, seven felonies, you should be deported. But San Francisco deliberately set out to protect people like this. And unless voters pressure City Hall, this policy will not change. And if you are somebody with a career record, where are you going to go? Where do you want to live if you plan on reoffending? San Francisco.
Dan, is this policy, can it be saved? I mean, is it,
well,
they're not talking about dramatic changes to the rule.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know,
ordinance.
I haven't covered it, but I've spent a lot of time thinking about it, and we can try and split the hairs as to exactly what Mercury, you know, clearly Mercurimi, it seems like, took it a step further. Clearly, though, basically the core of the policy is flawed. But there is a purpose in some sort of sanctuary city policy, setting aside the felony issues, right?
You're saying that you think it would be reasonable to have a policy that would, that if somebody reported a crime to the police, that they wouldn't be fearful that SFPD would refer them to ICE and be deported.
I mean,
but that is so 20 years ago. That's what it is. Now this is, we're going to protect people with criminal records. I mean, look, we have our DA pushed a policy that says we will not impound your car if you're caught driving without a license, because we want, that's okay.
Yeah,
I mean,
you see, it's 20 years ago in San Francisco. But the other issue of this is how it's playing across the country. And
Because that's where they'll all be in 20 years.
No, if you have
that quaint policy, given time, you'll be San Francisco. Because that's where it's moving.
I don't think that necessarily having some sort of sanctuary city policy means that you have to evolve to San Francisco's extremism. Okay, I think there are, 200 communities across the country that have them.
But there are a number of them do have similar policies.
Yeah, I'm certainly not defending what San Francisco has. The trick here is...
Not a trick. No, it's not a trick. You don't pass a law that says you do not comply with an ICE detainer unless it's somebody who's been convicted of a violent felony in the last 7 years. You don't have to pass out. You can get rid of that ordinance. You can say people who have criminal records, ICE wants a detainer, you hand them over. You could. That's, there's nothing. That's what it was, and could be again. Except City Hall doesn't want to do it.
Yeah. No. Right. But my only point is, I'm certainly not going to defend what San Francisco has because I don't think it's defensible. My point, though, is how this debate is likely to play out nationally is that we may swing completely the other way, and you won't have, and the reasonable part of this is going to get lost too.
Well, you know, all City Hall has to do is say, we went too far, we're going to get rid of it. Yeah. But no, instead, they're not doing it. And what is Washington going to do? They're going to cut off all funding for sanctuary cities. And it's because it's pretty clear when San Francisco won't back down that that's where the path leads.
I understand that.
I hear about is the extremist Republicans. Look at this city. What city in its right mind wants to make this kind of an announcement and have these values and has so little regard for people like the Bologna family and Kate Steinle that they're willing to risk public safety for this?
Deborah, I'm not disagreeing with
you.
All I'm saying is that...
Why isn't San Francisco doing this, Dan?
San Francisco should be changing it. It absolutely should. My only concern is how do we, on a national level, how do you start distinguishing this
Let's look at the national level. I mean, yeah. Josh, I know, is just dying to jump in here.
I'm keeping my mouth shut. I'm not stupid.
Well, just on the level of this talk on the federal level of defunding sanctuary cities, is that something that do you think has any likelihood of actually going through, or this is an expression of outrage?
I think it's an expression of outrage. I don't think it has much chance of actually going through, and you know, it would have to survive a veto, most likely.
The president will veto it.
It would be hard, you know, it would be pretty much a party line thing, although there would be some who would cross the aisle. But I think what's happening nationally and here to some extent is, you know, you've heard a lot of good points from both of these people, and they're both right, but there are a lot of people out there who are trying, in making these arguments, to perpetrate this myth that illegal immigrants, and Mexican illegal immigrants in particular, are responsible for some disproportionate share of violent crime, and that our streets are tremendously more dangerous because of their presence here. This is not borne out by the statistics. I'm not saying that cases like this, obviously, you know, Steinle and the other case.
The Bologna family.
Yes, yeah. It does happen. But it does not happen in a proportion that makes this the population that if you remove them, then all will be well.
It doesn't work that way. And what communities get it worst do you think it's good for the mission if, you know, somebody like Juan Francisco Lopez Sancho says, boy, I'm going to stay in San Francisco because I'm not going to be deported if I'm here? This is bad for immigrant communities. I'm appalled by what Donald Trump said.
From immigrant communities. Yeah. But we've also said that the average illegal immigrant story is somebody who came here to send money back to their families or to bring their families here to lead a better life. And I've not seen a single criminal justice department, FBI, local law enforcement statistic that indicates, as Donald said, that they're rapists, they're murderers, they're addicts, and some of them are good people, you know, which is the way that
he said.
You know, that was in his campaign rollout speech. You know, that was what started the whole Trump train a-rolling there.
An exit question then before we move on to our next topic, and that is just as one of our audience members asks, how does the future look for Sheriff Ross McGreemy? Maybe focus us on, is he going to be sheriff after the election?
This is going to be, if you're a real hard leftist, this is going to be a toughie for you, because on the one hand, you would probably not, you know, some defended him with the whole flap with his wife and the charges against him. But now you've got this whole. But now he's a guy who carried out due process for all. So that's a toughie, isn't it?
The irony is for him, this issue may play well in San Francisco.
Yeah.
For him, only change the uniform.
I know.
Okay. Well, let's move on to our next topic, and that is the minimum wage. The University of California system moved last week to raise its own minimum wage that it pays to $15 an hour. Cities like San Francisco, Seattle, Los Angeles, other cities have either already raised their minimum wage to $15 or are doing it in, you know, phases over the course of a couple of years. Is this Is $15 the new magic number, or is that where the whole country's going? Is there a national movement for this, or is this a city-by-city thing, and that's how it'll remain?
Well, it's happening city-by-city, and it's been happening for a few years, and I personally think that raising the minimum wage makes sense. The problem that I've had with some of it is that it's so inconsistent from city to city to city because there's no statewide movement to raise the minimum wage to sort of a more livable minimum wage. We've had some raising, but to really get it to this kind of level, 15 is, if I remember correctly from some of the other cities, they're sort of jumping a little bit ahead of the pack timing-wise. But this is the problem, is that it would be really a lot better if we could find a way to raise it in some sort of uniform way so that employers don't start locating. University is a unique situation because they are the employer. But and obviously they can self-impose however they want. But it would be good from community to community if you didn't start having such disparities so that employers start shopping or feeling picked on depending on what community they live in.
This is a problem that's much more of a problem in California than in other states for obvious reasons. I mean, $15 in San Francisco is very different from $15 in Bakersfield. Mm-hmm. So it's not as easy to set a statewide livable minimum wage, in California where you have this amazing gap in cost of living and income stuff, as it might be in a Nebraska or something like that. Not that they're considering it anyway.
And I agree with you up to a certain point, but the interesting thing is really, frankly, $15 an hour is barely, if at all, a livable wage even in Bakersfield.
Right.
We have always managed in the state to set some sort of minimum wage. It's just that there is now, and rightfully so, I think, more of a push to move it a little faster and to share some of the wealth from the top.
Ron Unz, who ran for governor as a Republican years ago, pretty libertarian guy, came out with an argument that I found pretty persuasive a couple years ago, where he said conservatives should support a raise in the minimum wage because basically it's better than giving more entitlement spending in other areas.
A lot of the folks who are earning these low wages are also receiving public benefits. Yeah.
And there would be less of that and more incentive to work, and I thought that made a lot of sense. Now, he was talking about raising the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. $15 an hour, let me tell you the problem with that. There are going to be fewer jobs. Now, I remember they looked at the numbers for $10.10 an hour, and they found about 500,000 people would lose their jobs, and 16.5 million people would make more money. So that sounds okay. That's a trade-off. You get to $15 an hour, and there's an incentive for a lot of employers to mechanize things, or move jobs and stuff like that. So I can see if city wants to choose to do that, so be it. But there will be consequences. That's a big jump. And I think, Dan, you were also talking the way you were talking about you want to see it sort of done more gradually.
Yeah, I want to see. The devil's in the details of it. Uh-huh. And every city in the Bay Area that's done this has done it in a slightly different way, be it Berkeley, Oakland, Richmond,
but I like
San Francisco.
That. But that's good because then you can see what works and what doesn't, and you want to have different minimum wages for more and less expensive cities.
Well, but frankly, all of them, the way they got crafted, they all have severe problems is what ends up happening.
It's just one with a severe problem.
Okay, but if you're an employer, you start city shopping a little to a certain extent. And I think that becomes a little bit problematic too. I mean, there were really interesting unintended consequences in Oakland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
That became very interesting having to do with the restaurant industry where because the restaurant industry poses some very unique situation, but it's on for the restaurant industry. The minimum wage is on top of tips, and there's already a disparity between what they call the back of the house and the front of the house. Mm-hmm. Well, all this is and it's the front of the house, the servers who may in the high end restaurants at least do really well, and the minimum wage raise all went to them. So what they're doing in some of these places, they're doing away with tipping to counterbalance this and redistribute within. And actually, it's worked fairly well in a few restaurants, actually.
Dan, you've talked about, you know, having a more uniform thing across the state. There is a push to do something uniformly nationally. Senator Bernie Sanders and some colleagues introduced a bill to raise the national minimum wage to $15. Now, considering that the Democrats have pretty much zero power in Congress these days, that's going nowhere.
Happen.
But
yeah, it ain't going to happen. I mean, Democrats, George Miller, the recently retired congressman from the East Bay, was a constant champion of raising the minimum wage. And once he accomplished an increase, he'd set about laying the groundwork for the next increase because it took so long to get it through. But yeah, in this Congress, it's more of setting a tone and sending a message than a practical matter, I think.
Okay. Well, let's kind of go into our political potpourri, if you will. President Obama recently commuted a whole bunch of drug convictions. So Deborah, as our official drug correspondent, tell us what's significant about this.
Well, this is... Basically, now the president has commuted more sentences than the last four presidents before him. And when Barack Obama first ran for president, he was very critical of certain aspects of the war on drugs and mandatory minimums. And a lot of people thought that he would be really good with using in his pardon power to commute the sentences of nonviolent drug offenders. And I wrote about this guy, Clarence Aaron, who had a life sentence for a first time nonviolent conviction, which was just obscene, and the president commuted his sentence a year and a half ago now, and that was great. That was one of I think 13. But in his first term, the president was very stingy, but now he really is stepping up to the plate. I think you're going to see regular commutations of this kind of scale for the rest of his term. I certainly hope we do. This is the one power that the president has that's completely unfettered. Congress can do nothing about it. And he's embraced it, and it's going to be something that he's going to be very, not stupidly aggressive. Smart. I think, all of these people had very long terms. Some of them, I think 14 had life terms. They get out in November. They'll be under supervised release for 10 years. And that's important to be cautious because you don't want to have something go wrong where people say it was a mistake. And he's picking the cream of the federal penitentiary system. I think it's that they're going to be people who move on with their lives. It's a difficult time. Clarence Aaron's still working in a hot wing place. And, I'd like to see him do better. But the fact that he's out and free, and he's with his family, and I mean that's fantastic. I think the next thing is to get employers to look at somebody like Clarence and giving them a second chance too.
When the president's commutation power, if that's the term, how does that? I mean, can it only be for like individual situations, or could he or she commute the sentences of like a class of conviction?
Yeah, I mean like. Draft dodgers, Gerald Ford.
Oh, power he used?
Okay. I think that the president's going to be more careful than that. I mean, there are advocates like groups from families against mandatory minimums who think there are thousands of people who could be released. Because the truth is, in the 80s, when they started writing these federal mandatory minimums, they went hog wild. And they just, and the crack sentences were obscenely long. And we're talking about taking away somebody's life. Bill O'Reilly really irritated me because one of the people who got a commutation, he was part. His grandfather had been a drug dealer, and he was part of this drug gang. And Bill O'Reilly saying, "How dare you do this? This is a dangerous drug gang." He was 20 years old when he got sentenced to life without parole. That's ridiculous. And it was a nonviolent offense. We need to have punishment proportionate to the crime.
President clearly signaled this also with his prison visit.
Yes, which came about a week after.
Right,
that's right.
I mean, he clearly He has an ear to this.
Yes.
That we really haven't seen in presidents past in quite the same way.
And yeah. The symbolic value is the main thing here, because the federal prison population is such a tiny fraction of the U.S. prison population. Most U.S. prisoners are in state prisons or local jails. And there are only about 200,000 people, I think, in the federal prison system, a huge majority of which are there for nonviolent drug offenses because of those laws. So, but you know, by making those commutations, by making that first ever visit by a sitting U.S. president to a prison, you know, he's basically saying this is a new tone that we're going to try to set in the federal system, and he's definitely looking to the states to follow suit. Of course, in California, we're under court order to reduce our prison population because of unconstitutional conditions. So, you know, we've been working on that for a few years, although I think the curve is about to start bending back. The projection is that the curve is going to bend upward again if we don't do something.
And we've really had the harsh sentences for violent offenders and repeat offenders. It's just crazy to send somebody who's 20 years old for a nonviolent drug offense away for the rest of their life to die behind bars.
And the voters in this state are starting to get that.
I think have for a while.
Okay. A number of questions here, all in different handwriting, so it's not the same person. But basically getting to the same issue of what other problems does Hillary have, what could be her Achilles heel in the campaign, and do you foresee it creating an opening in the race for another Democrat, or...
We mean other than the email thing that we talked about already?
Yeah.
Her Achilles heel is that people hate her, you know, and they've had a long time to hate her. You know, the people who dislike her have had decades to hone that dislike into a bright white hatred.
And a lot of them are Democrats.
Some of them
really, because we saw in 2008 Democrats couldn't run fast enough from her.
Yeah, but that said, I still don't see how she doesn't get the nomination at this point with things being as they are. Bernie Sanders. Out there, ringing the progressive bell, drawing 10,000-person crowds. Good for him. I don't think Bernie Sanders thinks he's going to be the nominee. I mean, he basically hinted as much when we talked with him when he was here in March. He is out there to drag the front runner, Hillary Clinton, a little bit further into those progressive policies. And she's sounding some notes. She hasn't embraced the Warren wing on Wall Street reforms and stuff like that yet. But she's been edging over there, so that's what's being accomplished over there. It's not the blood in the water feeding frenzy that you see on the Republican side, but you know there's a dynamic at work there.
The GOP has raised that feeding frenzy to a level.
I think you know the trust level. She's underwater in a number of states. On Colorado, a third of the people's trust her, and two thirds don't. There are a number of states like that. I think that if she starts to sink, Joe Biden gets in.
Joe Biden ain't going to get in. I don't.
Yeah, I mean, you don't know because people may push him. There's going to be the deal is if she looks like she cannot win in November, there's going to be a push to get some other. I mean, I don't see Jim Webb taking it. I don't see Bernie Sanders taking it. I don't see Martin O'Malley taking it. Could be wrong. Lincoln Chafee. I forgot Lincoln Chafee. And Jerry Brown, you never know. I know.
No,
Carl and I argue about this all the time.
He already said it's not going to happen.
Yeah,
okay.
Oh, really? And nobody's ever changed their mind and said that they're not going to run for president.
Yeah,
that's the only reason I think he may not is Ann Gust.
Yeah. You know, okay, but coming back to your question and bouncing off of what Josh said, the problem is not only that she racked up all this hatred or dislike from a segment, but she's never found a way to win them back. She needs to, if she's going to be successful, depending on who the Republican nominee is, she needs to find a way to mend fences in sort of a public way. I don't know what that is even. But if it's only diminishing support over time, that's not a winning strategy.
She's moving to the left, isn't she? So is that good or bad?
I think it's going to help heal some divides within the Democratic Party. I don't think it's going to help her in November. But I think it's easy for a candidate to be seen as floundering when you don't know who that candidate is running against.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of, you know, some of that negativity naturally is going to disappear when it becomes clearer, not even when it's clinched, but when it becomes clearer who the likely Republican nominee might be. When it comes down to those two or three or four, and you can really look at Hillary versus Jeb Bush, Hillary versus Scott Walker, without all the noise, you know, that's going on there. And I think when people start looking at that, I think her numbers are going to pink up substantially.
Well, but let me be a contrarian on that for 1 second. And that is, let us say it's a Bush or a Kasich or, you know, whatever, whomever it may be, okay? Those races and these presidential races are going to get decided by the middle. And the question is, how much of that middle, and I don't know that you may know this polling numbers better than I'm sure you do, you know, how much of that middle is comfortable with her and how much of it is uncomfortable with her? And what can she do to win over those who are uncomfortable with her or who simply have a historical dislike for her?
Yeah, I'd be a consultant campaign.
I mean, I guess what I'm saying is I don't necessarily agree that necessarily she comes up. It's going to depend on who the Republican nominee is. I'm not convinced she necessarily starts picking up when she gets head to head. It's going to really depend on the matchup, I think.
Okay. Well, this will all unfold as we go further in. Let's do our news quiz now. My prize distributor can come up and join us. For any of you who have not done our quiz before, I'll quickly explain what we do. I'll ask a question. Raise your hand if you think you know the answer. I will call on you. And if you get the answer right, this gentleman will just give you a bag of chocolate. So, our first question. What car company was fined $105 million? Sir, I saw your hand first. Fiat Chrysler, even got the full name correct. That's right. Former NBA star and current North Korea pal Dennis Rodman endorsed whom for president? Way in back there. Donald Trump. That's correct. You didn't think I was going to go without a Donald Trump question, did you? Okay. Kuala Lumpur, this is in Malaysia. Its $1 billion airport terminal is reportedly great, except for one problem. Do you know what it is? Only one winner per... Inserted in the back, did you want to guess?
It's sinking.
It is sinking, yes. I guess every flight will be... This is going to be a water landing. What do the 35 women who appear on the cover of the new issue of New York have in common, ma'am? That's right. They claim to be have been sexually assaulted by Bill Cosby. I already answered that one. Chris Mako took first place in what this weekend? Ma'am? No. Sir? That's right. The 38th San Francisco Marathon. Gentleman right there. Former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, remember him? He weighed in on a hot-button security issue this week. What did he say the United States should not do? You want to guess, sir? No, but it's sort of related to that. Anyone else want to guess? No? He said the United States should not release Jonathan Pollard, the man who was convicted 30 years ago, I guess, of giving nuclear secrets to Israel. Boston dropped out of the running to host what into you, right there in the blue.
Me?
Yes, you.
Oh, the Olympics.
That's right. They dropped out of the running to host the Olympics. They said that there just was not support to pay the billions of dollars to do it. Let's see. Lord Sewell. That's not a name.
Found guilty of cross-dressing prostitutes on film.
Not fully, so I'm not going to give it to you. And, sir, you already won. More. Okay, yeah. I thought she would have it, so I would just Jeopardy style, I would give you the question after the answer. The question is, Lord Sewell took a leave of absence from Britain's House of Lords after what happened? So something was revealed, ma'am. That's right. It was a combo act. He was videotaped doing... You did have part of it, and you got it. He brought it all together. Okay, let's do one more. We got a new look at 9/11 last week with the release of what? You already got it, ma'am.
The pictures that were going on in the White House Situation Room.
Right, in the bunker. They released a trove of photos of what happened in the bunker that day. We are going to have more news quiz questions and, of course, much more to discuss Monday, August 17th, at our next week-to-week here at the Commonwealth Club. Keep an eye out for us also in mid-September when we return to Silicon Valley. Thanks to our panel, Deborah J. Saunders, Daniel Bornstein, and Josh Richmond. Thank you to all of you here, everyone watching on TV and listening online. Have a great week, everybody.